Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of General Douglas MacArthur, Winston Churchill, Herbert Hoover, General Matt Ridgway, Congressman Joseph Martin, 36 hours in a B-36, and more than 40 men and women in the news in the 20th performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
Without command authority, I still proudly possess that to me, the greatest of all honors and distinctions, I am an American.
I can only wish, too, that a certain mustachioed gentleman from Moscow might have been with us. Perhaps he might then begin to cut his ambitions down besides.
We'll take off from here, go to New York, to Earlton, Canada, to Point X in Canada. Then we'll proceed to Denver, Mobile Point, for an RBS run on Eglin Field. Then we'll return to Fort Worth. Standard emergency procedures will hold.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
The first shock of excitement was temporarily over. The last truckloads of confetti and ticker tape had been hauled away. General MacArthur read and rested in his suite at the Waldorf. And for the first time since the recall, radio news programs led with something other than the MacArthur story. And in the nation's newspapers, the expansive eight-column banner headlines were narrowed down to four, then three, finally to one. And even that was moved from the coveted right-hand column spot on the front page as the war, from which he had been recalled, became once again the most important story in the news.
This is an effort to show, in a chart, the pattern of evaluated vehicular sightings, largely at night because due to our very effective air operation.
The voice you hear is that of Lieutenant General Matt Ridgway, as he patiently stood before his war maps in Korea and briefed correspondents on communist troop concentrations in the north.
Indicates the number of vehicles it represents according to the table on the right, and the arrowhead indicates the direction of such traffic as was observed. On the other hand, he is well grouped for offensive action. This concentration could very readily exert a very strong effort down with slight lateral displacement here, down the Chorwan-Sewell axis, down the Kumar-Sewell axis, which is the old invasion corridor.
The communist offensive, which Matt Ridgway had anticipated, came on Sunday, and right down the middle of the old invasion corridor, as he had expected. On Sunday night, an entire new Red Army poured through the mountain gap. Ridgway's 90-mile front was ready for them. For weeks, the long rows of 155s, long toms, had been in position. Their ammunition dumps well stocked, their breaches well oiled. These precision weapons laid down the most concentrated heavy artillery fire of this war. One division commander reported firing 20,000 rounds in 24 hours. The Chinese communists, without air protection or motorized support, continued to pour into the face of this. After 5 days, the army estimated that the North Koreans and the Chinese communists had suffered 37,500 casualties, killed and wounded. We fell back slowly, in order, without panic, heading for an undisclosed line where we would stand and fight the enemy. This was unquestionably the communist big Sunday punch. And if James Van Fleet, who succeeded Ridgway, could hold, it might be his last punch. But even if the enemy is stopped, the Korean War is a long way from being won, and our troops a long way from going home. As General Ridgway put it,
well, not in the communist timetable, you don't go home. You don't call this thing off. Isn't the end of a big league baseball season? You ring down the curtain when the final ball is caught. It doesn't go that way. The danger with our people, above any other people on earth, I think, is their impatience, their natural characteristics of impatience.
In Europe, a group of cold, hungry people continue to fight back in the Cold War, where final victory is as important as it is in Korea. Katalin Korady is a Hungarian motion picture star, a capable actress with an unusual singing voice. 6 weeks ago, like most citizens of Budapest, she turned on her radio and heard this.
A Szabad Európa Rádió bemutatja, köszönt a Szabadság című műsorát.
It is the voice of Free Hungary, Radio Free Europe.
This is Radio Free Europe, an independent propaganda weapon started by private citizens and operated by privately subscribed funds. One of Radio Free Europe's most important functions is to tell those behind the Iron Curtain how they can escape. Miss Korady and other Hungarians with a radio and the courage to tune us in hear broadcasts like this one.
It is not difficult to cross the Iron Curtain if you know how. Here is what you must do to get across. When you get to the border zone, 3 miles from the frontier, get off the roads. They are checked. Continue cautiously through the fields or woods till you reach that 500-yard zone just before the barbed wire. Then get on your hands and knees and crawl. If you see the border guard, don't run. Drop flat on your belly. The guard walks a straight route and will pass by. When you come to the barbed wire, feel out for the trip lines connected to the mines. Cut them. Be sure you wear...
Several weeks ago, Katalin Korady crossed the Hungarian border and was welcomed by Allied friends in Vienna. Now, Radio Free Europe has another new star and another new weapon.
Miss Korady got across the border safely. You can too, if you're careful. Here is Katalin Korady to sing for you.
Приліші тріфовою чупан, оте ночь серелена. О гюшігеш сівеме толан, мекшем ірдемете. Күнню тріфат үстіл чок велем, машол іш мар мектүрдім. Mosolyogni illenék, de könnyes a két szemem. Áprilisi tréfa volt a csók, mely a szádon égett. Bizonyára jól mulatsz azon a...
Elsewhere in Europe, the West was having its troubles. Britain signed a new 200,000-ton meat contract with Argentina, but the meat shortage continued, with Mr. Churchill making an occasional joke about the lack of British beef.
I shall always, always use this most useful and agreeable gift which you have made me, have given to me. I'm sure these knives here will, with their perfect quality of steel and workmanship, will suffice to cut up all the meat I am likely to require.
But Mr. Churchill was not the only British politician making jokes about British meat. Another member of Parliament this week was making a lot more news and giving the Attlee government a lot more trouble than Mr. Churchill. His name was Aneurin Bevan.
I'm asked the question here, what do I think about the closing down of two newspapers in Argentina? Now, if I give the answer to that, you wouldn't get any meat.
Aneurin Bevan, usually called Nye, is the socialist counterpart to Winston Churchill. A 53-year-old Welshman, dynamic, a colorful orator, his political views are diametrically opposed to Mr. Churchill's, and substantially to the left of Prime Minister Attlee's. This week, Nye Bevan rebelled against what he called Britain's overemphasis in arming at the expense of social service gains. He said, "We have allowed ourselves to be dragged too far behind the wheels of American diplomacy." With those words, the man who expects to become a future socialist prime minister left the cabinet, whose grasp of power is held by the slimmest of margins. With Mr. Churchill's conservatives once again asking for a general election, Mr. Bevan's departure from the cabinet may prove to be the very straw which could break Labour's weakening back and return to office the Tories, whom Nye Bevan hates so much and of whom he recently said,
"I've been looking at the people that Mr. Churchill is anxious to get back into power. I was looking at them all these years, all the people who are supposed to be the natural leaders of Great Britain. And I am bound to tell you, quite frankly, that every time I look at them, I get a sense of superiority."
Despite Bevan's resignation and that of Harold Wilson, president of the Board of Trade, the Labour government clung to its narrow majority and continued to govern. Herbert Morrison, the new foreign secretary, said that if it came to a choice between the rearmament program and the standard of living, then the standard of living would have to come down. Nye Bevan was the first man of stature in Britain to try to capture and lead the anti-American sentiment of his country. He agreed with some of Mr. Attlee's policies, but not all. But in this nation, facing one of its most trying periods, and about to make decisions as important as any we have ever had to face, talk of unity was scarce, and invective and accusations ran heavy, with the words traitor, appeaser, fascist, and warmongers appearing more and more in the Washington vocabulary. General MacArthur himself was dwarfed by the debate which raged over him and the policies that caused his recall. On Saturday, the New York Times, under the byline of their White House correspondent, Anthony Laviro, ran an article which stated that the Pentagon had files to prove that MacArthur had been wrong about Chinese intervention in Korea. Mr. Laviro reads part of that article.
Washington, April 20th. Today, the New York Times gained access to documented sources on the meeting of President Truman, the Commander-in-Chief, and the United Nations Commander on the Mid-Pacific Atoll. 6 months ago on Wake Island, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur, according to administration records made at the time, expressed doubt that Red China would intervene in Korea and offered his best troops, the United States 2nd Division, for service in Europe.
MacArthur's aide, General Courtney Whitney, claimed that no notes had been taken at the Wake meeting, that much of the time Truman and MacArthur were alone. Many Republicans, including Senator Richard Nixon of California, whom you hear now, claimed that the White House and the Pentagon were getting ready to smear MacArthur.
The American people should know that as the hearings begin into our Far Eastern policy, a whole staff of Pentagon and State Department officials have been ordered to comb the record of General MacArthur for the purpose, if possible, of destroying his past reputation. The tactics used is to disclose that portion of General MacArthur's record which would damage his reputation and to withhold that portion which would be in his favor.
In the Senate, where tempers and insults are becoming as much a part of the tradition as the gavel in the cloakroom, both sides lined up to call each other names, and the nation sat and listened with more concern than amusement. You're about to hear sections of a recent debate between the Democratic senator from Oklahoma, Robert Kerr, and the Republican senator from Maine, Owen Brewster. The first voice you hear is that of Senator Kerr.
I know that Red Russia is trying to maneuver China into trapping or inciting or enticing us into an all-out war with China. But, Mr. President, in their wildest moments of fiendish hope, Red Russia never expected a great military commander from America to openly promote their goals. Out of the shouting and tumult of this debate, the fact that emerges bold and clear is that the Democratic Party continues to be the peace party, while many Republican leaders have succeeded in showing that their party is the war party.
Republican Senator Brewster of Maine rose to answer this.
Is the senator from Oklahoma aware of the fact that three times in our generation, this nation has become involved in war, and that at the time the government had been under the control of Democratic administrations, in the first instance for 5 years, in the second instance for 9 years, and in this instance for 4 years?
Then Senator Kerr began getting a little rough about the Republicans.
They wouldn't know a policy if they met one in the middle of the road. They wouldn't have a policy if they knew one.